will come to order. I just talked about everybody being bright-eyed this morning. I can't even talk. We're in work session on House Bill 2152. Okay, I'm going to resend that. We have a special bill. We're going to go into hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2354. I believe it's Schnatsky, Michael Schnatsky. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Schnatsky, would you come up and identify yourself, please? Okay, Representative Jones.
Yes, as Mr. Schnatsky is taking his place at the witness location, I just wanted to say that this has been an interesting process of attempting to allow the show man to vote. And I think this committee is interested in looking at concerns in the election law and when they can disenfranchise a voter. So I would recommend that you give some consideration to his concerns and recognize that they probably affect others, maybe in your own constituency.
You mean he's not one of my constituents?
No, he's one of mine, and it's all right. Welcome, Michael.
Identify yourself, Mike.
My name is Michael Schnatsky. I'm currently stationed up in Bangor, Washington, aboard one of the Trident submarines up there. And the problem came up last year that I was out on patrol at the time of the absentee ballot being able to get up to me so I could vote. It was obvious when I called down and asked for the absentee ballot and so forth that it wasn't going to get there in time for me to get the absentee ballot. So I did some calling around, and everybody got involved in it. It's a big concern by the Pentagon. There's approximately 9% of military that were unable to vote in an election before last because of problems like mine. Because it's hard for military personnel when they're not in the States to receive the mail in time. 30 days is not enough time for receiving the absentee ballot. In my case, it was unique because I was underway and there's no mail delivery when I'm underway. It applies to aircraft carriers, to Army personnel, to you name it. There's just hard getting mail in 30 days and sending it back in time for elections.
I used to have an APO address, and I know exactly what you mean. This state has always supported and very strongly supported getting people to vote and trying to make it as easy for them to vote as possible. So I'm certain that your words fall on some very sympathetic ears this morning. Representative Jones, would you like to further explain this bill for the committee, since it's your bill? We're looking at... Yes.
For a moment. Did Ray Phelps sign up on the sheet?
No. Mr. Phelps, did you want to give some testimony on this morning? Would you come up then?
I talked to your office, and they indicated you would be. That's why I thought maybe
you
would
go ahead and sit right there, Michael. We'll even sit next to the Assistant Secretary of State. And if he gets out of line, just hit him a couple times.
Chairman Ray Phelps, Secretary of State's office. I've examined the bill, and I'm not bothered by it at all. I think it's a good bill. It is a good method to see that the individual has a ballot. Of course, it's understood that there may not be any information on the ballot other than the offices that would be applicable and any measures that may be known, which is sometime after the 60th day before the election. So there may be a little bit of a problem there getting information to the person, but I suspect that's not the issue here. I think the issue here is wanting to vote for the national offices in the legislative and statewide offices. I think that's the issue, and those offices are known. The candidates may not be, but at least the offices are known. So I have no problem with the bill. We are examining an alternative or a companion, depending on your point of view, and that is allowing for a 45-day cutoff for all, or a 45-day start point for absentee voting. In other words, making the ballots available earlier for all elections in the state of Oregon. That requires, of course, advancing some filing deadlines, particularly in the situation of special districts. The Defense Department has had two approaches to servicing the Americans servicing, living and or working and or serving in the United States Armed Forces outside the continental limits, and that is that either this method, which is called the Submariner ballot, that's its name, and it's available now in five different states, or it allowing a 45-day turnaround for absentee balloting.
Is Oregon one of the five states?
No, it is not. You have, and the states should not come as any surprise, are California, Washington, Maine, Connecticut. They're all the installations where you have the majority of your military.
The naval installations,
yes.
For the main part.
Yes. That's how it gets its name, Submariner.
Okay. Representative Jones.
Would you explain, Ray, what happened in the case of Michael's attempted to obtain a ballot? Would you explain what happened in the
case? Everybody got involved. And basically, the young man was frustrated because he wanted a ballot, and we were in a set of circumstances where we could not provide it. The law provides that the ballots be ready, you know, not later than the 28th day before the election, which means we could have made the ballot available in some part or form before the 28th day, but not completely. And as a result of not having the authorization to make a partial ballot available to a person, hence inviting a problem of maybe a contest or a disfranchisement allegation and so forth, we had to remain in the position that until we had all the information and we were able to provide him a complete ballot, we could provide him no ballot. And that's one of those situations where, as a bureaucrat, you know you can do better, but you know you cannot. And that is the situation we found ourselves in. And I have more empathy for him than a lot of people, but there was nothing I could do. And it did happen on my shift. So.
Ray, let me ask you, in Section 2, Sub 2A, the name and current mailing address of the applicant. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say when he made application, we're talking about Michael and everyone like him, mm-hmm. and we're talking about the 90th, not sooner than 90th day prior. Let's say on the 89th day, he made application, and as the military sometimes does, they move the service personnel.
Right.
How can the absentee ballot catch up?
Well, I would say in the same manner that all the mail would catch up to the person, and I'm not familiar with how that works, to be honest with you. But it would, I'm sure, follow the individual, especially, I would think, initially, as much as there is knowledge at the permanent duty station where that individual may have moved, and you're not talking 6 months or a year or whatnot. And if you're thinking about the other measure we had, we're talking about, you know, periods of years have elapsed on a military registration, and that measure, which we're asking for, you know, some consideration on maintaining our registration records, has nothing to do with this. I believe that the military, and I've talked to persons at the Department of Defense, the man who runs the program is Hank Valentino, and they make every effort to get these ballots to wherever they are.
Well, an APO number is
booked. Yes, sir.
I just have had some problems with the Secretary of State's office because the U.S. mail never got my C&E to you in time.
Well, we're not talking about the quality of the United States mail. We're talking about the processes of the Department of Defense to get the ballot to the individual.
Okay, we're separating the two then, huh?
I sure am.
I would, too.
Are there questions of either witness? Yeah. Did you have more to say, Michael?
I was going to say that if a person knows, you know, let's say he mailed, you know, mailed out the request, and he knows, he can always give a call down here if he's that concerned about it, and have him tell him the new address, because he will know.
I see. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about.
The other thing, too, Mr. Chairman, is that in a separate process, an individual who's what's called a long-term absent voter, and that's military personnel as well as United States citizens living outside the continental area, can apply once a year. So if the military is aware of this. Mr. Valentino is, and it's part of their instructions and part of the information that goes with the PCA form, that postcard form that most...
Well, that's part of whose instructions?
Department of Defense. They handle all the long-term absent voting for the United States.
Do they relay that information?
Yes.
I asked
yes,
Michael,
I
they do relay that information to you.
Yes. Yes, we cooperate with their form that they design, and we cooperate in a booklet they put out. And a great deal of information there. Quite frankly, the frustration is, as Michael pointed out, it was simply that you couldn't get there from here. And this would allow us to do that.
Okay, thank you very much. Vicki, do you want to make a statement on this? Do you have any problem? Representative Jones.
The current regular ballot, absentee ballots, are mailed out on by what time?
Not earlier than the 28th day.
28th day, prior to the election,
yes,
right?
Yes, and we are close, and I mean very close, to coming to the committee and showing you a proposal that would expand and lengthen that time period for voting by moving up the absentee, or moving back, whichever way you want to look at, the time that a person may apply for an absentee ballot. Because this will solve part of the problem, but the next part of the problem is going to be, yes, but who's running? I've lived in Africa for 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure I know all the names and all the things and so on and so forth. And there are more people living outside the United States, more United States citizens for longer periods of time. So we do need to explore this, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. So it's going to be a proposal, whether it goes anywhere or not, in a final form or not. That's remains.
We'll give you a fair hearing.
I know you will.
Representative Jones.
I might just follow up on that to our own elections officer in Washington County. Michael Cox indicated that he felt that he supported this bill very strongly, but the concern he had was that we have an awful lot of people this still is not going to address, and that is those people who need to know what measures are on the ballot, what candidates are on the ballot, that we're really not getting, because the 28 or 30 days is just not a very long period of time in which to get absentee ballots to the voter.
No, it's woefully short, quite frankly. I know myself, the turnaround mail between here and Washington, D.C., if we all do our very best to get it moved quickly, it only takes me 8 days. And that's first class, and it takes 4 days to get there and 4 days to get back. That's just the way it is, and I can tell from the postmarks.
Isn't there a 35-day... they have to have the ballot titles and everything in 35 days prior to the election?
In some instances, there are 40 days, and that's part of the 45-day proposition we're going to bring to you, is that some of that's going to have to move upward.
Because that you're already cutting down yourself on this one end. You can send him anything you want, even a year ahead of time, but he isn't going to get any information until we have some changes in that law, because the information has to be into your office, and if it only has to be in your office 35 days prior, by the time you assimilate and print it out and all, you've cut this gentleman and people like him considerably.
Well, that's right. And frankly, that's been the process that's been the part of the process that's always paid the price, is the absentee ballot. When people think that what we need to do to have an election is go to work on Monday and, have a press conference and we'll do it on Tuesday, and I'm exaggerating, but I'm making my point. And you say, well, what about the absentee voter? And they say, well, there's not that many of them. Gee whiz, it's only this little small fraction, and we'll just do the best we can. Well, that's reversed. The absentee elector is becoming a larger part of that participation, and then the military also.
The way the state of Washington solved this was that your special absentee ballot, submarines ballot, whatever you want to call it, person that, president, and you filled in the blanks to the best of your knowledge. And then they have space for special bills and whatever on the bottom, where you knew of some bills, you could fill that in. When they'd still send out the regular absentee ballot, and if for some reason you got the regular absentee ballot, then you fill that out, and that take precedent over, they'd throw out the special absentee ballot. And I don't know if there's any provision for that in here, but...
Would we do the same? We would not.
Not in this particular bill.
Would you like to see that done?
Could you address it in another bill, I think?
He might do it in the omnibus bill that we have.
I would rather take that up in the 45-day thing. I'd rather keep this bill clean and think about the other.
Okay.
Obviously, anything can be done. I'd like to think myself through the mechanical process.
But it would be the proper thing to do, Ms. Gay. Okay.
Is there any questions? Has anyone on this committee have any problems with this bill as you see it this morning? Okay, since there's no problems in this bill, I'm going to go from hearing to work session on the bill. And under work session, do I hear a motion?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2354 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jones moves House Bill 2354 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any opposition to that motion? If not, you will carry the bill.
Was that a requirement?
Okay, so we got the vice chair's business taken care of. Now we'll go on. We've got to take care of this. I think I'll go right to it. I think we'll go for this one. Okay, let's. Vicki? Vicki? Were you going to do so? I'm trying to figure out what bill to take because we're under. Was your testimony 2282 going to take long?
Not necessarily.
Okay. We're going to hearing on House Bill 2282. We're just under time constraint. I'm not trying to cut your time short. It's just that I'm trying to figure out how to budget the time we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Vicki Irvin. I'm the Director of Elections in Multnomah County. This bill has gained a little bit of notoriety for possibly being one of the frivolous bills of the session. In the county clerk circles, it's known as the Mickey Mouse bill. And I have the distinction of having my name on it for some reason. It arose from a general discussion of a problem that does exist currently with the write-in votes, but you will find that we have given some amendments that in essence will scrap the bill and get at the heart of what we are really after. The amendments will do two things. The first is that all write-in votes will indeed be counted. And the second thing is that I don't have to lose a lot of sleep agonizing over whether or not Santa Claus really does exist. First of all, let me make a distinction. Under the proposed amendments, all write-ins indeed would be counted. The only differences would be in the process used to actually do the tallying. Tallying write-in votes is very time-consuming and involved. And we are distributing to you a set of write-in tally sheets from the primary election of 1984 in Multnomah County. Each set, you will find, has a sheet for tallying votes cast by Democratic voters, one for Republican voters, and one for the non-affiliated voters. Each precinct is tallied on two sets of these sheets, but we've only given you one of them. After the tally is completed, the two sets are compared. If they are identical, then one set is marked duplicate and put aside. But if they don't match, then the ballots are retallied to determine the error and correct it. Every single write-in vote is tallied by precinct. Each of you has a different precinct's tally sheets. After this is done, however, the votes must be sorted and recompiled by office so that they may be recorded on the official abstract for that office. In Multnomah County, for the primary election, we tallied 17,056 write-in votes. Now, that figure does not include write-ins for precinct committee person. But in our county, we only had six offices where the actual names written in had an impact. Five of those offices had no filed candidate, and one office was involved in an organized write-in campaign. And yet, we spent over 1,700 personnel hours and $6,800 to put that information together. This proposed legislation, as amended, would address that situation. The amendments would allow us to tally all of the write-in votes simply by the office that they were cast for, instead of by the individual names written on the ballot. There would be three important exceptions to this. The first, whenever the total miscellaneous write-in votes equaled or exceeded the first runner-up on the ballot, then the votes for that contest would be retallied to show all names. This would immediately identify whether a write-in candidate would be involved, for instance, in an automatic recount. The second, whenever an office had no filed candidate, all names written in would be individually identified on the tally sheet, since the winner would obviously have to be elected by write-in. And the third, whenever a write-in campaign was organized, then that candidate could request that his or her name be tallied separately. This legislation would have required us to tally by name only 1,381 votes out of the 17,056 which were cast in our last primary election. It would have saved nearly 70% of the cost to tally the votes while assuring that each and every write-in actually was counted and included in the final abstracts of votes cast.
Vicki, when I'm looking at this, just a point of personal, the total write-ins means the write-ins on both all candidates involved.
Yes, all candidates.
Thank you. Okay. We are now in hearing on this bill. We are not in work session, and the amendments are handed in. We have a committee rule of 48 hours, so I'm not going to go into work session on 2282, but having taken your testimony. Questions? Representative Phillips.
Just one, Vicki. If you knew, let's say, Representative Springer was going to try a write-in vote for something, would this make it easier? I mean, you knew there was an organized campaign going on rather than a wide variety of other miscellaneous names. Would this assist you in the administration in counting up of those write-ins or have nothing to do with it?
Representative Phillips, if there were an organized write-in campaign, if Representative Springer were going to do that, then he would notify the filing officer for that contest by the 11th day before the election that, in fact, he would like to have his votes, write-in votes, broken apart so that he'd know how many he got. And this would help us to get a handle on that so that we could isolate just those that in fact, would have an impact or might have an impact on the outcome of the election.
If for some reason, though, if I may, there was no prior notification, but there was a kind of an organized grassroots, whatever you want to call it, and there were a lot of names coming in, and you saw a pattern developing, would this assist you there, too?
Representative Phillips, unless it fell into one of these three categories, we would still lump those all together under a category of miscellaneous write-in votes for that office. I think that reflecting back on the times when we have had organized write-in campaigns, that there was plenty of time in advance when that campaign would be able to notify us to tally them.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Vicki. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2282? If not, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2282, and we are in work session on House Bill 2152. While we are in work session, I am going to ask the Gene Snyder and the people from General Services to come up, and I want to have a review of House Bill 2152, and if we could start going through it. There are a number of proposed amendments to the bill. I would like to deal with each one of those proposed amendments as we go through the bill so that we can take them one at a time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gene Snyder, Administrator of the Risk Management Division of the Department of General Services. Before I go through the bill point by point, I'd like to make just a brief introductory remark. House Bill 2152 deals with the way the state manages its affairs in the purchase or self-insurance of its risks of property and liability. It requires state agencies to purchase their insurance coverages through the state. It has an important fiscal impact to us. We are estimating in the area of $300,000 for the coming biennium. And it also, in the face of the tightening insurance market, gives us the ability to self-insure risks that we would now have to purchase insurance for. So it's a very important business-related bill. The committee has received a draft opinion from the Attorney General dealing with a very complex legal issue as to what is a tort. There's about 30 pages of written material on this, and it's an important issue that should be considered. And since it is a legal issue, the Department of General Services is prepared to amend one of two bills that it has introduced in the House Judiciary Committee at the chairman's pleasure to bring this policy issue into focus in that committee. It is not required to be reviewed as a part of House Bill 2152. So with that, I...
Okay, before you start on, we all understand the members' concerns of this committee. Mm-hmm. Representative Springer, have you any problem with the statement just made?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'd all been kind of waiting for this draft opinion. Oh, yeah. I called over the AG's office late yesterday afternoon to see if it was available then, and apparently it was not. It's my understanding it's just been made available to us this morning. It's 25 pages, 29 pages if you include the footnotes. I've been able to read about 5 pages of it this morning, kind of trying to listen to the hearings too. It appears to be an excellent analysis, at least as far as I've written, had a chance to read it. It states, as far as I got on page 5, that really you can't separate the issue of tort, you know, under the Tort Claim Act and what it is that GSA is going to be covering and its responsibility as a state agency. That's my reading so far of the opinion. Mr. Snyder and I discussed this possibility when I first discussed my amendments with him in terms of separating these two issues. At this point, I don't know that you can separate the two issues, and I'm not sure what the options are. I guess this committee could take this bill and kick it up to Judiciary Committee, recommend that go up to Judiciary Committee, and certainly I'd be glad to deal with the issue up there. Or I guess the committee can always choose to accept Mr. Snyder's position and sort of finesse this one, if you will, and sort of count on another bill, if you will, making it through the process, starting with the House Judiciary Committee, and certainly if that's the committee's desire, you know, we'll tackle that issue. I am kind of concerned that it's my sense that we've literally had to pull this issue like a tooth out of some people who I guess I would have thought would have brought this to us as a bill originally. If this was a problem, I feel like you know, we should have a little bit more proactive position by those people who are responsible for administering or defending under the Tort Claim Act. So I'm trying to get over that sense. I know Mr. Snyder is very sincerely concerned about the fate of the bill. I recognize it is a priority issue, I guess, with General Services. I always kind of, the more pressure I feel on a bill, the more I tend to slow up on it, I guess, was part of my response, too. But That's kind of where I'm coming from in terms of just barely getting a chance to chew on this draft opinion, which I think, you know, tries to address an issue which I think we have to really confront in this bill.
Bill Nestle, would you sit up here with Dean Snyder? You heard Representative Springer's concerns. I'm going to ask you, because we have 3 bills other than 2152 in this system.
Yes.
One is the one that Gene just alluded to as far as tort. We have 2 others that will be expressed in this bill later. But addressing the tort question, is it the AG's opinion that question can be answered on a separate bill that will bring 2152 in line with perception of what tort is?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've examined it, and we feel that the areas of amendment could most easily be addressed and probably most appropriately in House Bill 2154, which has to do also with the defense of claims made against state officers, agents, and employees, and would require two rather non-complex amendments, one to ORS 30.2651, the definition of tort, and another to ORS Chapter 278, which would indicate the responsibility of the Department of General Services to provide defense costs, indemnification, and so forth in claims that are torts.
And so you're answering the indigent on one hand and a tort on the other with those two bills?
That's correct. And we do believe that 2154 represents probably the best way to present that, because it permits us to relate the broader question with the state's responsibility to indemnify individual officers and employees as well.
Do you have a position with 2154 and